Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Charles Kaiser. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Kathy Ritzer. And as the court knows, this is a case of judicial review of the dismissal of a public school teacher. Ms. Ritzer was a longtime special education teacher for the Academy School District, and the findings of fact indicate that she taught the most disabled students in the district, and she was an excellent teacher. The issue before this court is the reasonableness of an order that Ms. Ritzer returned to work after she had been told that the district did not want her to come back to work, and after she had paid another job, which the prior fact found was a reasonable effort to mitigate her damages. The school board, as the board knows, the administrative law judge made findings of fact that everything Ms. Ritzer did was okay, and that the order to return to work was a pretext to find an excuse to dismiss her when the district knew, as a practical matter, that she couldn't come back to work. The board makes three arguments as to why this particular order was reasonable and why the administrative law judge was wrong. The first argument is that it has the power to order a teacher to return to work while she's on administrative leave. The second argument is that it's reasonable for the district to order Ms. Ritzer to return back to work because they were paying her, so they say we might as well get some work out of her during the pendency of the leave while the dismissal process was playing itself out. And the third argument that they make is that Ms. Ritzer created her own problem and her own dilemma by accepting another job while she remained at least a de jure employee of the school district.
Counsel, let me interrupt you just a moment before you go further on that. I want to ask whether the ALJ's finding that the district's order was unreasonable is subject to any deference by the district or by us. In other words, is that a legal conclusion or is that a factual finding?
Well, this would be my position, Your Honor. There's two prongs to insubordination, or two prongs, well, to whether an order is reasonable. The first prong is whether the employee had a present ability to comply with the order. Under Red Lion, that's a finding of fact. The second prong is whether the order had a reasonable relationship to an educational purpose of a school district, and that's the Cornish case, and that's just black letter law on reasonable directive. The second prong, I would submit, is a question of law. It's an intermediate question under McCroskey. As the court will recall, McCroskey was a physician licensing case. McCroskey held that in that case, generally accepted standards of practice, it is a matter of ultimate fact for, in that case, the medical licensing board to determine, because the medical licensing board is composed of physicians, those physicians have expertise, and they were performing their duty to protect the public. But McCroskey also recognized that under some circumstances, generally accepted standards of practice in a medical board case can be a question of fact for the trier of fact. I mean, my position in this case is that that's a decision. The evidentiary facts, of course, are found by the administrative law judge. My position is reasonableness is a question of law, which this court can consider de novo. So with all due respect, Judge Hawthorne, I'm saying it's neither. The educational purpose, I mean, that's my position. But I want to be clear to this. Have I answered your question, Judge Hawthorne? I'm not trying to.
Yes, thank you.
But my position is under any standard of review, what the board did in this case fails, even under the arbitrary and capricious standard as enunciated by the law case, that this decision, and also under the case law that says the board's decision of ultimate fact must be squarely grounded on the administrative law judge's findings of evidentiary.
So why was Dr. Peek's order and the timing of his order, why was that unreasonable?
The reason it was unreasonable, Your Honor, was Ms. Ritzer had been already told back in May that she wasn't coming back to work, that they had no intention of bringing her back and they were going to fire her. So therefore, knowing that, And under the administrative law judge's factual findings, she took a job with another district to mitigate her damages and said, I'll come back if I win in front of the board and give 30 days notice required by statute to the other district. So as of the time he gave the order, Dr. Peek was well aware of that fact, and well aware of the fact that she couldn't come back to work. She couldn't abandon her students and her other district without breaking the law, and B, without severely compromising her students, because the administrative law judge also made a factual finding that special education students need continuity of education. In addition,
yeah, even though you said that the board was aware that she was doing this, it was still a unilateral decision on her part, right?
It was a unilateral decision on her part. That's right, John.
So basically, it could be viewed as thumbing her nose at the board.
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record that had Ms. Ritzert asked, can I take this other job while the dismissal process is playing out, the board would, or the district at that point, you know, the board was presumably impartial, the district would have said, fine, go ahead. They never argued that at below, and they never, so therefore there's never a factual finding that would have made any difference. So, I mean, I understand that the district administration felt like she was shoving her nose at them, but they'd already told her she wasn't coming back. I mean, and there's also no reason to trust them, I mean, given what they did, which goes to the other reason why the order is unreasonable, is because the administrative law judge found it was a pretext. The administrative law judge made was clearly a raw finding of evidentiary fact that the only reason the order was given was to put her in the dilemma that it put her in.
Well, let me ask you a question about pretext. Generally, we see pretext arguments being made when there's an impermissible reason, such as racial discrimination or exercise of some sort of protected speech, you know, something of this nature. And so here you're just saying that perhaps the order wasn't the real reason, but why does that eliminate the statutory ground?
Well, Your Honor, because how can something be reasonable and be pretextual at the same time? And I mean, with all due respect, I'm not the one who's saying it. The administrative law judge is the one who found it.
My background's in criminal, so let me give you an example from criminal law. They often argue pretext when a police officer thinks someone has drugs, but they don't have probable cause for a stop. But if they see some traffic violation, even if it's not the real reason, it's not considered unreasonable. So here, if you actually have insubordination, even if the court is happy that she was insubordinate because it gives them a reason to fire someone that they were just unhappy with, how does that affect the reasonableness of the decision to fire for insubordination?
Because unlike in a criminal case, it's an objective standard. Do they have probable cause, even if it's a pretext, and the case law clearly holds that. Under Cornish, Your Honor, the order has to have a legitimate relationship to an educational purpose. So the reason the pretext is important here is that the judge also found that there was no reasonable relationship to an educational purpose. In Cornish, they told the teacher, I think, to turn in his or her lesson plans, which was related to an educational reason. In this case, it wasn't. That's why pretext matters.
Well, you're saying that a school district doesn't have a right to have teachers who aren't acting in an insubordinate way? Then that's not related at all to an educational purpose?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, if the court, they clearly, but for the facts of this case, in the abstract, I don't dispute that a school district can make a teacher work while she's on administrative leave while the dismissal process is playing out. There's no question about that. I don't dispute that. But in this case, that's not why they did it. In fact, they cost the district money because she offered to refund most of the 100 days salary. So, I mean, if the court's going to say, and I mean, this is really my understanding of the district's position, we can do it because we say so. We don't need a legitimate reason. I'm saying, Your Honor, I'm asking the court to determine that they did need a legitimate educational reason to give the order.
So you're saying in this context it's a subjective rather than an objective standard?
Well, it's not completely subjective standard. I mean, it fails on both grounds, because objectively, under the judge's factual finding, there's no legitimate educational reason to make her come back. All they're doing is costing themselves money.
Counsel, I don't think either party disputes the definition of insubordinate, meaning willful or intentional refusal to obey a reasonable order of order of a lawful superior on a particular occasion. Now, does the inclusion of the word reasonable within that definition of insubordinate, does that restrict what a school board can and can't do?
Yes.
Is that your position?
Yeah.
And so does that effectively become, you know, like a duty of good faith?
Well, it's a duty of reasonableness, which is similar to a duty of good faith. I mean, that's what the case law clearly holds. And the other point I'd make in terms of standard of review, Your Honor, is under the Flaming case and the Witter case, which the school district cited in footnote 13, those are both cases where the school board was interpreting its own physical intervention policy. So the court, in both of those cases, the Colorado Supreme Court said, those are cases in which we're going to afford a school board some deference. The idea of a reasonable order, that's not created by board policy, that's created by the courts in the case law that both parties have cited. That's why we're saying that there's no deference. And I mean, you know, the whole statute is a limitation on the school board's authority. They don't have unlimited authority to do whatever they want, or to tell them to employ whatever they want. That's what this court has already said. I mean, the other thing I'd ask the court to consider is a public policy matter. I mean, if Ms. Ritzert, under the factual findings of this case, if Ms. Ritzert hadn't taken the other job, they would never have ordered her to come back, and she just would have been sitting home collecting a paycheck. That's not what she did. She, first of all, went out and did something useful, kept her professional skills up, helped handicapped children, and mitigated her damages. And there's certainly no guarantee, especially given the way this process works, where the party that initiates the case and the party that was told by its own lawyer that they could predetermine the sanction of dismissal before they heard all the facts. I mean, there's no reason to rely on that. So as a public policy matter, don't we want to be encouraging people to mitigate their damages? And I guess the other point I make, because I'm seeing my lights yellow, is, I mean, what kind of process is this? Where everybody, I mean, the school district's lawyer, the superintendent of schools, the parents whose complaint initiated this whole thing, get to talk to the board, but not Ms. Ritzert. I mean, the other thing that's important in this case under Lawley, because you have to consider all of the pertinent facts that a reasonable person would consider, is they never had proof, and they never proved the underlying factual allegations that caused this to happen in the first place. So,
and those aren't the subject of this appeal, correct?
That's right. But that's what the record reflects, is they didn't, you know, they said we're going to fire you, and then it turned out they couldn't prove any of it. So, I mean, we're asking this court for justice. We're asking this court to rule that what happens in the real world is legitimate, and we're asking this court not to encourage teachers to just sit home and do nothing. I mean, Ms. Richards, they should have been happy. This was a win-win for everybody taking this other job, and this order was unreasonable. And so we would ask that the board decision be reversed under whatever standard of review this court ultimately decides to apply. I'd like to save the rest of my 2 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please the court, Stu Stellar, Kaplan and Ernest, attorney registration number 220-82. I'm here today on behalf of the Academy School District number 20. Your Honor, the case before you is very straightforward. It is, as Mr. Kaiser said, judicial review of the board decision to dismiss a teacher. That board decision is very straightforward. It's two pages, the first and second page of the stipulation regarding the record. The record against which that decision is measured are the evidentiary findings of the administrative law judge. No one here is disputing the administrative law judge findings, so that record for purposes of this appeal consists exclusively of the hearing officer's findings. That's page 36 to 52 of the record. So you literally have a case in front of you with a record of 14 pages. Now, the basis for dismissal was insubordination. Insubordination is a willful refusal to follow a reasonable order. This is an issue of reasonableness. The question is, was this order reasonable? As the Colorado Supreme Court made clear in Flaming versus Board of Education of Yuma School District, reasonableness is a finding of ultimate fact. It is a finding of ultimate fact and therefore lies within the exclusive prerogative of the Board of Education, subject solely to the statutory standard of review, arbitrary and capriciousness.
Does reasonableness incorporate a good faith standard? This is relating to the pretext argument. If the order was just a pretext for firing someone that they wanted to fire but didn't have good enough reason otherwise?
Sure.
Does that affect the reasonableness of the order?
A couple of different responses to that. Two things that Ms. Ritzer cannot deny in front of this court is that she failed to track her student's progress outside the IEP. Another thing that she cannot deny is that she failed to provide support to the general education teachers instead in terms of modifying the curriculum for the special education teachers.
Those spaces for potential discipline are not being appealed here. The only thing that's being appealed here is the insubordination portion. So could you respond to Judge Forrest's question about, you know, how far does the, I think she's getting at, how far does the school board's authority extend? Does it get to be arbitrary and capricious? And does it matter how reasonable or unreasonable the order is that's directed to the teacher?
I'm not asking the court, let me be very clear, I'm not asking the court to affirm on a basis that the Board of Education did not take, but I am responding to the point that they did not have reasons to be concerned about her dismissal. So with respect to this issue of a pretext, let's say that the Board of Education or the principal saw a picture of the teacher in the paper wearing a Chicago Bears jersey, decides you're going on administrative leave, we're going to fire you. The teacher then gets a job in a different school district, refuses to report to duty for the old school district. What is the school district supposed to do? This is not a pretext. It is a good reason for dismissal, refusing to report to duty. Ms. Ritzer is arguing that she was merely mitigating her damages. Your Honors, the only way that you can rule in Ms. Ritzer's favor is to overturn the Teacher Employment Compensation and Dismissal Act. Let me explain what I mean by that. The Teacher Employment Compensation and Dismissal Act has provisions written into it to protect teachers throughout this process. The Board of Education rejected Ms. Ritzer's proposal to go beyond those protections. If that's arbitrary and capricious, then the statute itself is arbitrary and capricious. The dispositive question here today is whether it's arbitrary and capricious. That's the standard. For a Board of Education to dismiss a teacher who asserts that she has a continuing right to employment but no corresponding duty to work. And that's an easy question. There's not a workplace in the country where someone can assert, I have a right to continue employment, but I do not have to work.
I'm not sure that she's saying she has a continuing right to employment. I think her position is that she had a duty to mitigate, and that the only reason that she took this other employment was to minimize any potential damages that, you know, that would accrue as time passes, especially given that she had no communication from the school board from the time that she was placed on administrative leave until after the start of the school year. At a minimum, then the school board or her school have a duty to say, we are or we are not, one way or the other. We are going to be calling you back for duty or we're not going to be calling you back for duty. Should she have a reasonable expectation of some notice, some information about what her fate is?
Your Honor, you've noticed that when the school district learned that she had taken this other job, contacted her counsel, the idea that there was no communication back and forth is simply not accurate. Now, with respect to this issue of mitigation, at the time that she took that position, there were no damages for her to mitigate. At the time that she took that position, she was a non-probationary teacher employed by Academy School District. At the time that she took that position, she was still receiving full compensation. At the time that she took that position, the administration had three options: return her to a classroom, transfer her to a different position, or move forward with dismissal. When she took that other job and said, I'm not coming back to work there except on my terms, those first two options were taken off the table, not by the administration, but by Ms. Ritzer. The school district had no option but to move forward with dismissal.
But what expectation did she have but that she would not be returning when two highly placed officials had both said, you're not going to see the inside of an Academy classroom?
Yeah, if this was a straightforward decision, it would have gone to the board in June. It would have gone to the board in July. It would have gone to the board in August. It didn't. Undertaking a teacher dismissal case is a very serious decision.
It requires hiring outside counsel to represent the administration, hiring outside counsel to represent the board, disrupting the school. You exhaust all other means of addressing the situation before you move forward with dismissal. And with respect to the mitigation of damages, the Teacher Employment Compensation Dismissal Act provides that even after a recommendation for dismissal is made, that teacher is entitled to full pay for 100 days or until the board makes a decision. That's 2263-3023. And subsections 4 through 9 put together a process to ensure that that decision is made within those 100 days. Then, under subsection 10, if she chooses to appeal an adverse decision, then this court is to decide her case on an expedited basis, second only to workers' compensation cases. And if she is reinstated, she's entitled to back pay for that period of time. Those are the protections that are included in the Teacher Employment Compensation Dismissal Act. Ms. Ritzert wanted more. The school district said, we will live by the statute, and it simply can't be arbitrary and capricious to live by the statute unless the statute itself is arbitrary and capricious. Your Honors, again, this should be a very straightforward decision. There are no genuine issues of disputed fact. We're bound by the hearing officer's findings. Ms. Ritzert is saying that she could have saved the school district some money. Ms. Ritzert was proposing, you pay me something for me doing nothing. The school district had a better deal. We'll pay you FTE, full-time equivalent salary, for full-time equivalent work. That is not an arbitrary and capricious demand to place upon a teacher. If Ms. Ritzert's argument is accepted, what is to prevent a school teacher who doesn't like her place of employment, doesn't like her school, decides that she's going to go out and get a different job over summer vacation, and then notify her old school district, I'm not coming back to work, but I'm not resigning. I still consider myself to be a non-probationary teacher of that school district. This is exactly what Ms. Ritzert was doing. For the school district to say, listen, if you are going to be considering yourself as a teacher with non-probationary status here in the school district, you're going to have to work for that. Administrative leave is never permanent. It's not a vacation, and it's not termination. And the school district retains the authority to order that person to appear for meetings, to order that person to appear for duty. Ms. Ritzert was not in a position to unilaterally change the terms of her employment in the school district outside the restrictions of the Teacher Employment Compensation and Dismissal Act.
How do you respond to Mr. Kaiser's comments? Go ahead if you need to get a drink of water. Go ahead. Mr. Kaiser's comments that Ms. Ritzert was bound, I guess, by some statute. I'm not sure that Mr. Kaiser mentioned it. I'm not familiar with it. But by some statute or by some law to continue educating and teaching the disabled students in the other school that she had taken a job with and could not leave them for 30 days. What impact, if any, does that have on this decision?
Why didn't that statute apply to Academy School District? She's saying it didn't apply to Academy School District because I didn't resign, but she didn't show up for work. That's a distinction without a difference. The statute is 2263-202, I believe. I'm getting that number correctly. And it requires that a teacher contract have a provision written into it that the teacher recognizes that the teacher will have to pay some sort of damages if the teacher breaks that contract and doesn't give at least 30 days notice. That's the provision that he's talking about.
So that provision would have been in Ms. Ritzert's contract with the Academy School District.
That's correct.
And does the record indicate, I don't recall this, that Ms. Ritzert entered into a separate contract with Falcon?
Yes, absolutely. She entered into a second contract with Falcon before the start of the Academy school year.
So that contract would have had the similar provision contained in that.
That's right. Both contracts would have had that provision in it. Again, Ms. Ritzert committed herself to two different employers. Ms. Ritzert was going to have to make a decision. She didn't make that decision. She forced the school district to take this action. Your Honor, if there are no other questions.
Just one last question.
Sure.
I guess I'm having trouble with just ignoring the findings of the hearing officer. The hearing officer had Ms. Ritzert in front of him. The hearing officer had Dr. Peek and, you know, with it, whatever other testimony was presented. And, you know, isn't that person in the best position to decide who is credible, who is acting reasonably, at least, you know, given the explanation that they provide at the hearing? So, I mean, how are we to ignore the hearing officer's, you know, determination? I mean, he saw these people and he made a determination that she acted reasonably under the circumstances, given all the facts, given the information that had been relayed to her by at least two different school officials that she would not be returning. I mean, she had no expectation that she would be called back.
Your Honor, I would refer you to Flammy. In that case, the hearing officer found that the teacher's conduct using a musical baton, actually I think it was a 3-foot wooden pointer, to go whack some kid on the head was reasonable. The teacher had already done that twice and been disciplined twice before. His finding of reasonableness was not binding upon the Board of Education, because the Board of Education is the one that has to assume the risk of employing a teacher like that. The finding of reasonableness is something that is made exclusively by the Board of Education. That's controlling law, Your Honor. The question is whether or not the board's decision was arbitrary and capricious. Again, we're not challenging the hearing officer's findings of fact. We have no basis for doing that. The question that all boils down to, both Mr. Kaiser and I are in agreement with this, is the issue of reasonableness. Where we depart is who gets to make that call. Again, Colorado Supreme Court made clear in Flaming that the Board of Education gets to make that call. Mr. Kaiser refers to McCroskey, saying that McCroskey's medical board decision, this is a complex decision, that so it makes sense to let the medical board make that decision. Well, in some ways that's dismissive of what it takes to run a school district, as if any person can do that. Second, that's a decision that the Colorado Constitution vests in the elected representatives of that school district. And third, again, it's the risk. Who will be facing that risk gets to make that decision. And this court can overturn their decision only if that decision was arbitrary and capricious. Your Honor, I have 36 seconds. If there are any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them. If not, I thank the court for your patience and for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stella. Mr. Kaiser, you have right at 2 minutes or so.
I just want to respond to a couple of things that came up in colloquy. First, Mr. Stella's argument is we don't want to pay the teacher for doing nothing, but that's exactly what they planned to do until she got the other job. And they didn't offer her, they didn't award her to come back until after school started. So you, Judge Boris, asked, was the teacher thumbing her nose at the district? I mean, the answer to that is when she took the job at Falcon, she wasn't thumbing her nose, because the way the record stands and the reality of the situation is she had no reason to believe they'd want her to come back. So no, she wasn't thumbing her nose. She didn't do what she told them to do after that, because she had already committed to Falcon and she had her students there that she had to deal with as a practical matter. So, I mean,
when she's under contract with one school district, though, is she free to make a different contract with a different school?
I mean, the issue of this case is, was their decision reasonable? And the judge found that it was.
Well, was it the decision that was reasonable or the order that was reasonable?
Well, it's a two-step process. I mean, you're asking, was she free to contract with another school? The judge made a factual finding that yes, she was. Because she didn't have any reason to believe that the academy would want her back. So my answer to your question is yes.
So you enter into a binding contract, and just because you don't believe that it's going to be continuing, then you can just willy-nilly enter into a contract with someone else that's also binding? And when they come into conflict, somehow it's reasonable for you to have done that?
My position, Your Honor, is that as a matter of fact, which the judge determined in his favor. The other thing I'd like to say is the school district argues that there's no damages because they're paying Ms. Ritzer. Just sitting at home and not working is a damage in itself. Your professional skills deteriorate, it's harder to get another job. So it's not like she was asking for a paid vacation. I mean, she did just the opposite of what the school district's claiming she did. So I see my time is up. Just for any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser.
Thank you.